podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. I promised a couple of special episodes in the World Championship Week. And this is one of them, if you're wondering. I know people will be saying, well, we'll decide that. But it's a bonus episode. It's an idea I've stolen. And let's be clear, I've stolen it completely from Neil Foulds. Now, Neil last week for Sporting Life wrote a piece, his top five players who've never won the World Championship, the best five players not to win the World Championship. So I'm going to expand on that a little. I'm going to do a top 10. I do read Neil's piece, though, and I'll explain some of the criteria. It's kind of players who could have been world champion, should have been world champion, and maybe would have been world champion for various reasons. So we'll get straight into it. Now, there will be a top 10. I'm actually going to start, though, outside of that with a player who, well, it's self-explanatory. It's Paul Hunter. Now, I didn't want to put Paul in the top 10 because where do you rank him? He's completely different to all the other players because, of course, he was denied the chance to have a long career. He died at the age of 27. So I didn't want to sort of work out where he should go in the top 10. He's sort of a bit separate from the rest for obvious reasons. I think, you know, you look at the players around now, Ronnie and the class of 92 and some of the others, you know, even the Hawkins, the Carters, mid-40s, that's what Paul would be now. So he would still, every reason to suspect, be at the top of the game. I passed away in 2006, so we're talking another near on 20 chances he would have had to win the World Championship. Of course, famously lost in the semi-finals in 2003, to Ken Doherty. He only actually won five matches at the Crucible. He won a match in 2001, lost quite heavily to Stephen Hendry. 2004, he won a match and lost in a decider to his good friend Matthew Stevens. But of course, in between that semi-final in 2003, led 15-9 against Ken Doherty going out into the last session. I think it was an incredible recovery from Ken. I mean, Ken that year that's what he was doing. He was winning close matches. It was a kind of bit of a fairy tale from him. But it's worth sort of reflecting on how well Paul had played to actually get that far in front, really played to a very, very high level the whole championship. But obviously it was a massive disappointment to lose. He'd beaten Ali Carter in the first round. He'd beaten Matthew Stevens heavily in the second round. So he'd had a couple of good wins. And then in the quarterfinals, he beat, in a decider, Peter Ebdon. Because Peter Ebdon was the defending champion. Led Ken Doherty 6-2, 11-5, 15-9. Lost the first five frames on the resumption. He won the next, lost the last three. So that meant, obviously, he wasn't in the final against Mark Williams. But as I say, you know, it was every likelihood he would come again. Of course, in this period, he was winning the Masters. He won that three times. He was very much a top player. Won a couple of other tournaments as well. It's interesting, though, I mean, so many of the winners at the Crucible have been introverts. Paul wasn't. He was gregarious. And maybe, actually, Wembley Conference Centre, where he won those three Masters titles, better suited his personality. But I just think he would have had so many chances to win it. The likelihood, certainly, he would have been in finals. And, you know, we'll never know, obviously. We'll never know. But he would have had chances to win it if terrible fate hadn't intervened. So I wanted to start with Paul. But then I'm going to go to the top 10 now. Number 10 is Rex Williams. Now, Rex Williams, of course, was one of the early professionals. Fine billiards player, many times billiards world champion. Former English amateur snooker champion. And he, as a young man, was hoping to have a good career in professional snooker, which, I mean, there wasn't much of a professional game then. Joe Davis had retired. The World Championship sort of shut down in the late 50s. And Rex Williams was one of the main reasons it was revived. He, through his own energy and his own innovation, sort of got it back on. But it was played as a series of challenge matches, and he played a number of them against John Pulman. It was John Pulman who won them. So that was his big chance. He's only playing one other person. so it's a two-horse race, but he still lost out, which I think that alone qualifies him for this list. But then in 1972, really the big chance, he was playing Alex Higgins in the semi-finals, and they got to a decider, and Rex Williams had a pretty straightforward blue, building a lead in the frame, and he missed it, and Alex Higgins eventually won the frame, and he won the tournament. And Clive Everton has described that as the shot that changed snooker history, because obviously it propelled Alex Higgins into the spotlight, which in itself propelled snooker into the spotlight. Rex Williams missed out on the chance that year. And by the time the Crucible era came along, it's not true to say he was past his best, because he was in a ranking final in 1986. He was a top 16 player for a few years in the 80s. He played at the Crucible 8 times, didn't win a match there, which is a record he jointly... Well, a record is not maybe the word, but it's a sort of... well, it's a record he jointly holds with Cliff Wilson. 8 times, didn't win a match there, but his chance had come long before then. So Rex Williams could have been world champion in his era, but wasn't. And it's worth saying, this list, it's not, strictly speaking, the 10 best players, because most of those would probably be on the circuit now. I'm trying to take into account the different eras people have played in, and therefore the different opportunities they've had to be world champion within those eras. So they're not all going to be current players. It's not, strictly speaking, who I think are the best players. It's just a list. Let's not get carried away with sort of too many explanations. Now, number 9 is a player who may play there this year. He's playing literally as I record this, and on Monday his match will be concluded against Hussein Vafai. It's Marco Fu. When Marco Fu broke through in the late 90s, he was a revelation. He got to the Grand Prix final, first tournament basically he played in on the Pro Tour, because he'd been world amateur champion. And there was a lot of excitement, because James Watanar from Thailand had been thought of maybe as the first Asian world champion, but Watanar was always just behind the Hendries and the other top players of the time. World number 3, and he won tournaments. He was a terrific player. But Marco Fu, because he sort of broke through so quickly, people started to look at him. Will he be the first Asian world champion? Now, of course, in due course, Ding Junhui, spoiler alert, we'll come on to Ding later, he sort of took over that mantle. But Marco Fu definitely was a player for a while who, you know, you went to the world championship and he would have been not one of the first 3 or 4 favourites, but he would have been in the lineup certainly as a potential winner. He got to the semi-finals in 2006. Well, he beat Ronnie O'Sullivan, first of all, in 2003 in the first round. Ronnie made a maximum, but Marco Fu beat him. 2006, got to the semi-finals. Peter Ebdon beat him in a decider, 17-16. So that was his first big chance to get to the final. Who knows what would have happened against Graham Dott. Maybe it would have been a different sort of match to the one Ebdon played against Dott. Maybe it would have been a bit more flowing. Marco Fu'd his best a sort of metronomic style in terms of his break building, very fluent break builder, very heavy scorer, and maybe it would have been a different sort of final, and maybe he would have had a chance there. He got to the semi-finals again 10 years later, so 2016, Mark Selby beat him there, 17-15. That was a chance to play Ding, and again, that would have been interesting, because that would have been 2 first-time finalists. By the way, the last world... And here's the thing. I'm just throwing out gold here, throwing out nuggets. But the last world final to feature 2 first-time finalists, i.e. 2 players who've not been in the final before, was 1981. 1981. Steve Davis and Doug Mountjoy. Incredible. You know, we're going back 43 years. But anyway, that's a side issue. But who knows, because they were first-time finalists, whether Fu maybe would have got the job done. We'll never know. This is all parallel universe stuff. Fantasy stuff, really. But Marco Fu, I think, deserves to be on the list. Number 8 is a player from primarily the 1970s, although he played professionally into the 1990s, Eddie Charlton. Now, Eddie Charlton reached, 3 world finals, and he was a player who, in that era, was just behind the big hitters, John Spencer and Ray Reardon, Alex Higgins. So there was a sort of big 4. He was the 4th member of it, but he was very much 4th. But you go to the early 90s, you had the big 4 was Hendry, Davis, White and Parrott. John Parrott, to a degree, was number 4 there, but of course he broke through and won not only the World Championship, the UK Championship, various other tournaments as well. Eddie Charlton was a tough-as-boots old player, clearly. I mean, he was someone who, you know, had a very particular style of it. I mean, they called him Steady Eddie, so that's the that's the clue as to his sort of style of game. The first sort of emergence really was late 60s. He played one of those challenge matches against John Pulman, who beat him. Then he got to 2 finals in the 70s, where I guess he had really more chance of potentially springing a surprise. And the first of them was in 1973 against Ray Reardon, and Reardon got the win there. But then 1975, now this was in Nunna Wadding, Australia, or the final was anyway. And, of course, Eddie Charlton on home soil, you know, would have been not fancied, but given a chance, certainly. It was a long old match. It was first to 31 in those days, but he led 29-23. So two away from the title. Ray Reardon won the next seven frames. Eddie Charlton won the decider. Now, Ray Reardon, I interviewed him last year, and he told me that in the deciding frame, he knocked in a long red. And Eddie was sort of standing, waiting to come to the table, thinking he played safe. Reardon knocked in a long red, and Eddie went to sit down and missed his chair, so sort of collapsed on the floor. And Ray had to go over and sort of help him up. Now, that's how he tells it. Some of Ray's stories, you know, they're great stories, but without being there, I couldn't sort of absolutely verify it. But that's what he said anyway. He made a 60-odd break, I think 62, to effectively win the decider. So that was his... I mean, that would have been a big deal for Eddie Charlton to win the World Championship in his own country. By the time the Crucible era comes round, obviously he's sort of getting on a bit. You know, we talk about players now, but I mean, Eddie, well, he would have been nearly 50 by the time the World Championship went to the Crucible. But I mean, he was there in three more semi-finals, 78, 79, 82. In fact, Reardon beat him in 82. It's the other semi-final that year, people remember, White and Higgins, of course. And he carried on playing there till 1992, because he was the first player to be whitewashed. And that was the end of his sort of Crucible career. But certainly in the 70s, and certainly in 1975, in that match that I've outlined, he had a chance to become world champion. Number seven, I'm going to say Stephen Maguire. I think people forget now, you know, how sort of highly rated he was. Maybe, well, 20 years ago now. 2004 was the year he really broke through. He'd been known about before then, and had sort of threatened to do things, but won rank him in Malta. And then at the end of the year, got to the final of the British Open, and he won the UK Championship. And in both events, he beat Ronnie O'Sullivan, who said Maguire will dominate snooker for 10 years, which is a big thing to say. It didn't happen. I guess you could argue nobody really dominated in that period. Steve Maguire still won tournaments, but they were kind of sporadic, sort of spaced out. But he was still, at that point, I mean, he got to number two in the world. He would still have been regarded several times as one of the favourites, amongst the favourites at the Crucible. And, of course, he got to the semi-finals in 2007. That was his big chance. That was the year. It was 14-10 up on John Higgins in the semi-finals, but lost that match. 2012, again, a semi-finalist, but it wasn't to be. And since then, well, he's had three quarter-finals in just over a decade, which I think for a player of his sort of, the way he's sort of rated by the other players, seems a poor return in some ways. We don't know whether he's going to qualify this year. I always think he's a sort of dangerous player at the Crucible, but it just hasn't quite happened in terms of reaching a final. But 2007 was his big chance. Now, players 6 and 5 on this list, they're both seeded this year, so obviously they can still win the tournament. Number 6 in Mark Allen. A player who, for all his success, has never really done much at the Crucible. He got to the semis in 2009, and then again he got to the semis last year. And I think it was more significant last year because this was really sort of new game, the new balance in his game. It's no secret, because last week we did the predictions podcast, and I've tipped him to win this year. So his name may be removed off the list. But it kind of seems odd in a way. A player who's won the UK Championship, who's won the Masters, who's won now 11 ranking events, has never been in a world final. What's the reason for that? Is it a stamina issue? I don't think it's pressure, because he's got a good temperament. Something hasn't clicked in Sheffield, for whatever reason. But, as I say, May this year. And number 5, also seeded this year, is Ali Carter. Now, I think Ali's got to be on this list, because he's been in 2 world finals. And he's the only player in the Crucible era to have been in multiple world finals and not won the title, apart from another one who you probably know who's going to be, who's coming up later. So 2 world finals. He ran into Ronnie O'Sullivan both time. And of course, Ronnie, by the time he played him in the first one, Ronnie had won it twice. So he was a multiple world champion already. And then, of course, they played in 2012. And you know, that was his fourth world title. He was always going to be hard to beat, Ronnie O'Sullivan. But Ali had played some great snooker along the way. I do think the Crucible, we're talking about venues that suit people. I mean, he's not necessarily spoken overly fondly of the venue, but he does seem to produce some good snooker there. Obviously made the maximum in 2008. I kind of fancied him to go deep last year, lost in the first round. But he's seeding 9 this year. He's in that little section that Luca Brasel's in, and that could potentially open up a little bit. Got Sean Murphy in there as well. But it's an interesting little top section. I just think, for all the other success he's had, the World Championship at the moment has eluded him, but it's not necessarily, you know, again, he's not necessarily going to be on this list in the future. He could definitely win it, but at the moment, he's appearing on this list because he hasn't. Number 4, these are the best players not to win the World Championship. In some cases, not to win it yet. Number 4 is Doug Mountjoy. He sort of came through late 70s, world amateur champion, won the Masters, won the UK Championship. So he'd won big titles, and you get to 1981, and he beat Willie Thorne, he beat Eddie Charlton, he beat Dennis Taylor, and then in the semi-finals he beat Ray Reardon, and he made a 145 at the time, the highest break in the history of the World Championship. So at that point, Doug Mountjoy, you know, was very much becoming, well, had become a top player and a big threat, I think, in the World Championship. In the final, of course, he played Steve Davis. Steve won the first 6 frames and kind of held on to that lead. I mean, it got a bit close, actually. I think it was 10-8 at one point. But Steve won 18-12. He won all the frames in the last session. But Doug Mountjoy was certainly at that time one of those players who would have gone to the World Championship as one of the, you know, that group of favourites. And, of course, he had a late revival in his career. He didn't do much at the Crucible after that. I think one quarterfinal in 1984. And he sort of slipped away a little bit in terms of the rankings. But then he won the UK Championship in 1988. So suddenly he comes back as a bit of a threat late in his career. Didn't really go deep again. But I think early on, definitely, he was a player who, you know, certainly would have been talked about. Obviously, the World Amateur, the Masters, the UK, would have been talked about as someone who could potentially win the tournament. And much loved player, actually. He had the sort of red frilly shirts, and he had a certain presence, Doug Mountjoy, around the table. Of course, passed away, sadly, a few years ago now. Now, the top three, I'm going to read the names out and then explain the thinking, OK? Because it may be controversial. I say controversial, nobody really cares. But for the purposes of the podcast, this is my reasoning. So number 3, I've got Ding Junhui. Number 2, I've got Matthew Stevens. And number 1, I've got Jimmy White. Now, it's perfectly acceptable, and Stephen Hendry has said this, to think that Ding is the best player of the three in terms of just pure his game. I think people kind of forget how good Jimmy White was. I mean, Jimmy was a fantastic player in his prime. But Ding, obviously, as we speak now, has won more ranking titles, 14, and, you know, very accomplished break builder over 600 centuries and the rest of it. So it's fine to think that Ding is actually the best player in terms of sheer standard of the three. But in terms of the best player not to win the World Championship, this is what I'm factoring in, okay? When did Ding not win the title when he should have? Because I can tell you when the other two should have won it. Jimmy White, too obvious standout moments, 1992, leading 14-8 in the final, just 4 away from winning, lost the last 10 frames to Stephen Hendry. 1994, he's in the decider, 17-each with Stephen Hendry, misses the black, only needing a few more pots to win. So they're two moments where he had a golden chance to win the tournament and didn't. Matthew Stevens was in 2 finals. In 2000, he led 13-7 against Mark Williams, so was in pole position, just 5 frames away from winning. Mark Williams came back and beat him 18 frames to 16. And then in 2005, he led 10-6 overnight against Sean Murphy and was beaten again 18-16. So again, you can say, OK, those 2 finals he was in control of, maybe he should have won them. Ding has not been in that position. Ding reached 1 final. He lost the first 6 frames to Mark Selby and got beat. What other year should he have won it? You could argue, OK, that year he won the 5 ranking titles. 2014, went there, lost first round to Michael Wasley. But there hasn't been a clear moment where he could have actually won the World Championship, whereas with the other two, there were. With Jimmy, there were quite a few. It's worth saying, though, with Jimmy White, I mean, obviously, he's had this round his neck, this whole, you know, not winning the World Championship thing, six finals. He lost to Steve Davis in his first. Steve Davis, the king of the 80s. He lost to Stephen Hendry in four more. Stephen Hendry, the king of the 90s. Steve Davis and Stephen Hendry were the two, obviously, outstanding players of their era. In the 20 years that encompassed the 80s and the 90s, between them, they appeared in 16 World Finals. Okay, so they were the absolute governors. It's no disgrace losing to those two. The other final he lost was obviously to John Parrott, 1991. First session, and it's on YouTube. It won't take you long to watch it, just over an hour. I think it's 73 minutes. He won the first seven frames. They played seven in those days in the first session. And the snooker John Parrott played in that session is as good as anything you'll see now. In fact, it's better than a lot of what you'll see now. That was an outstanding session. It's up there with what Judd Trump produced against John Higgins in 2019. Fantastic. So Jimmy was just outplayed, and that can happen in that session, and then never quite caught up, lost by the same amount, seven frames, 18-11. So this thing about he should have won it, well, OK, I mentioned two finals where he was in control, but he was losing to top players who were accomplished winners, and that needs to be kind of remembered as well. Matthew Stevens, it's again, you know, he's still playing, but he's sort of mid-ranking player. It's kind of forgotten a little bit as well, I think, just how good he was. He was very much, you know, top five or six for a good few years. If you look at 2000, when he got to the final, he'd already been in the final of the UK Championship. He won the Masters. So in the big events, he was coming good that season. Mark Williams, I mean, I was there. We go back to that Moby CD I was talking about. That I used to listen to every day, but Mark Williams would have started favourite for that final. I mean, he was UK champion already and he'd won the Masters before, but not an overwhelming one. 2005, that was a more even match. Obviously, Sean Murphy hadn't quite come from nowhere, but he was a qualifier and less known to the public. Matthew Stevens, without going back, I imagine would have started favourite for that final. Without checking, that's what I would imagine he would have been. Obviously, he wasn't a regular tournament winner. He won one ranking event, the UK Championship in 2003. But he was very much a player who went deep in a lot of events, and he kind of felt like he was definitely good enough to be world champion. It just didn't quite happen for him. So, number three, Ding Junhui. Number two, Matthew Stevens. Number one, Jimmy White. Obviously, Ding, you know, he's in it again. This year he's seeded. Maybe it could still happen for him. I just think, though, if you ask, and this is not necessarily proof of anything, but I'm sure if you, it's like they're doing pointless, if you asked 100 people to name a player who never won the World Championship but kind of should have done, I'm sure most people would still say Jimmy White. So that's why he's number one. It's all a bit of fun. It's not intended to be controversial. I just thought I would put this out there. Let us know your thoughts. SnookerScenePodcast@mail.com. SnookerScenePodcast@mail.com. The next episode will be the 300th episode of the Snooker Scene Podcast. Oh, yes. People said it would never last. A lot of people hoped it wouldn't. But we're still going, and it'll be live from the Crucible. I say live from the Crucible. I'll be stood outside on my own, talking into my phone. It's not really the spectacular that you know, maybe you would think. But anyway, we don't have a budget. But I will be, it'll be a short episode, don't worry. I may just catch up with some emails as well, because then the next episode, 301, will be on Thursday. That'll be the draw for the first round. I'll be reacting to the draw, and then we get into it. So that's it, a short episode. A lot of people will say pointless, but in so many ways, isn't it all pointless? You know, we're just saluting the great game and saluting some great players there. None of them have been world champions. Some of them still have a chance, but they've all played their part, not only in that tournament, but in the fabric of the game as well. This episode may have been no good, but anyway, it's been short. So for now, we'll wrap up there. And as I say, our next episode will be live outside the Crucible. But for now, it's goodbye-bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.